I'd like to thank everybody for joining us for Best Practices in 360 Feedback, the Challenge of Doing It Right. All of us that are on the call have had the opportunity to share experiences with each other about stories that we've heard from client organizations. And in some cases, we've been told that people have had memorable experiences with 360 Feedback, but for all the wrong reasons. And we're hoping that this session helps you to avoid some of that. I am going to go ahead and place the session in mute. I'll be right with you. Okay, this is just a quick sound check. Rogine, can you still speak?
Yes, I'm still here.
Mark?
Yep, I'm still here.
Rick?
You got it.
Okay. Okay, thank you everybody. Thanks for joining us for Best Practices in 360 Feedback. I'd like to introduce our speakers for today's session, our presenters. We have a panel of presenters that are going to take us through today's topic, Best Practices in 360 Feedback. First, we have with us Mark Spool. Mark is the founder and president of Management Development Solutions, a consulting firm focusing on leadership development. Mark has 30 years of domestic and international experience in coaching, 360-degree feedback, competency models, employee surveys, and performance management systems. His breadth of consulting experience includes companies in retail, finance, pharmaceutical, manufacturing, oil, and service industries, as well as small business and government agencies. I'm going to stop for just a moment and ask the folks that are with us today to not touch the slides because a little bit of housekeeping. I skipped right by that. Let me just go back here. I'm going to ask if you would not touch the slides. The way this system is set to work is that any of us can actually take control of the presentation. And of course, we'd like to give the presenters that are speaking the ability to do that. So I'm going to ask you if you would kindly not touch the presentation as we are presenting today. We would certainly appreciate your help with that. So back to Mark Spool. Mark's breadth of consulting experience includes companies in retail, finance, pharmaceutical, manufacturing, and the service sector, as well as small business, government agencies, and not-for-profit. Mark has a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology. He is the lead judge for the HR Department of the Year and the CEO for the Year Awards. He is also Baldrige Certified Examiner, and he has taught at both Penn State and Villanova University. Rogine Baxter is our second presenter, and she is the founder of the Bridgewater Group in 1986, that's 25 years ago, focusing on leadership, management, and team development. Rogine's work has brought increased organizational capacity and talent retention to companies across three continents. She works in partnership with clients to align their business goals and strategies, performance needs, professional development, and performance support. Rogine is a certified management consultant, and she is also a registered nurse with a BA in behavioral science and a master's degree in career and human resource development from John F. Kennedy University. Rick Stamm is the founder of the Team Approach, a 25-year-old team and leadership development firm. Rick was also the founder of Gateway Placement Institute, a 40-year-old nonprofit that still strives to continue with Rick's original vision to find employment for people with disabilities that pays equal or better than minimum wage. Rick describes himself as a consummate problem solver and idea person. He serves as the co-president of the Central PA chapter of ASTD and is a host of the Red Rose Learning Network in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Rick retired as a lieutenant colonel from the Air National Guard, where he served as a pilot and aircraft commander for 20 years. He graduated from Penn State University with a graduate degree in community psychology. I will serve as your host today. My name is Susan Stamm. I'm the president of the Team Approach. I'm the creator of the Team Leader Cafe Executive Forum in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the host of Bookends Book Club, a a monthly program featuring author interviews with thought leaders of our day. I'm the author of 42 Rules of Employee Engagement and the co-author of 10, the top 10s of employee engagement. I have a bachelor's degree in management and organizational development from Eastern Mennonite University. We're going to begin today with our first presenter, which will be Rick Stan. And Rick is going to talk with us about readiness in organizations for 360 feedback.
Well, thank you, Susan. This question is probably one of the most critical, I think, from my point of view. Is your organization ready for 360 feedback? There are any number of factors that can doom your 360 project to failure and make it very difficult to attempt it again anytime soon. We have seen this over and over. A few things that you might find going on that could sort of doom it to failure. If your organization has recently reorganized, people may not be in a position where they really know each other well enough, or they may be in roles that they've not had an opportunity to really get comfortable in, and so it's not a good time to do 360 feedback. If your folks are unfamiliar with 360, very often that creates problems, may move into a climate of mistrust. They may be thinking things about 360 that aren't true. If they have inexperience in just giving and receiving feedback on a day-to-day basis, it could be a problem in instituting a 360 feedback project. And of course, there are those fears, rumors, urban legends that folks coming from other organizations may bring into your company. Our goal when we're working with organizations with 360 feedback really is to help them develop a culture of feedback. And we see these kinds of projects as a way to move folks towards that goal. So we encourage people to not rush it. If at all possible, use a readiness survey. Begin to educate the whole organization on how you're going to be using 360 feedback. And we really recommend that 360 only be used for development. The readiness survey could be a great way to help you get started. It can surface some concerns that might be in the organization. It can clear up false information. It begins to educate the whole organization, not only about 360 feedback, but about feedback in general. So the survey itself can become an intervention. You may learn things about your organization that will point you in directions of other things that you need to do to help your organization. When we do a readiness survey, the categories we generally would look at would be these four, and I'll give you an example in each. What is the feedback climate? An item on the survey might be, if asked to give 360 feedback, I'd feel comfortable giving honest and truthful responses. Awareness and acceptance. An item might be, I understand what 360 feedback is and how it works. Your feedback practices. A good item might be, my boss gives me timely verbal feedback about my performance. And what are the development practices in your organization? Something like, after receiving 360 feedback, my boss would help me in my efforts to develop myself. You can see that this not only sets the tone for beginning a 360 feedback project, but also starts to sensitize people to the whole area of feedback. We'd like to start with pilots, and most of the organizations we've worked with do begin with a pilot program, generally beginning at the top of the organization, helping executives role model how to receive feedback. Definitely do not want to target problem performers in a pilot program. You want to make the pilot very visible. You want everyone to know that it's happening. Another good practice is orientation. It can make a huge difference in the readiness of your folks, the quality of the data that they provide, and the just overall participation. We'd like to offer orientation programs to both the subjects and the raters. With the subjects, we like to do some sort of an orientation for them before we kick off a project, get them really tuned into what the goals are, make them feel comfortable with the whole process, and have them really looking forward to it being a positive experience. And then for the raters, we want them to, again, feel comfortable and positive about the experience. We like to show them screenshots of what the online assessment might look like, and show them a sample report so they know what their information will look like at the very end. So we want to try and provide ways for everyone to get involved with the information. So orientations, any way you can do it, can be a very powerful way to get going.
Thanks, Rick. We're going to introduce Mark Spool at this point, who is going to talk with us about our next tip, which is design with the end in mind.
Thank you, Susan. Once you determine that your organization is ready to do 360, then you should be moving into the planning phase of the 360 project. You know, there's an old expression that goes, pay me now or pay me later. So anyone who's done a 360 project knows that it is very critical to design the 360-degree fee project with the end in mind. And now there are a number of critical areas that, that are involved in upfront planning. And the title of this section, Design with the End in Mind, really comes from Covey, which talks about begin with the end in mind. So the first thing that you need to be thinking about is, why are you even doing the 360? What is it that you want to accomplish or get from the 360? Certainly you're going to be thinking about who the raters are, but also other people that may be involved in the 360-degree project itself, whether it's what's the role of the boss, is HR involved in this, et cetera. Now, I'm going to be also going into more detail on some of these, including the next one, which is who sees the results. So I'll just mention that that's a part of the planning process, just like figuring out what questionnaire you're going to use and the items and the length of it, et cetera, as well as the communication. And I'll go into more detail for each of those. Part of the upfront planning includes what the report would look like. So Rick talked about in the orientation program, it's sometimes valuable to show people here's what it would look like in the generic form. So designing the format of the report is important. You need to do that upfront. You need to spend a lot of time thinking about how you're going to deliver results, and I'll also go into more detail about that. And I would say that while it may be listed last here, accountability is very critical, because a lot of organizations that do 360, somehow, even though they all start off with the best of intentions, it just dies on a vine. And the reason is that it's not followed up. While they initially stated that we want to do this for development, there's not necessarily an expectation to measure that sort of development. So this is very critical. So the first question is, and this is probably most important to the person who, whether you call them the recipient or the subject or the ratee, is really critical, who sees the results. So when 360 started way back when, and we said it was for development only, it was mostly a requirement, a lot of firms that did 360s, that only the recipient see the 360. And the reason is that you want them not to be worrying about what someone else would be thinking of them if they were to see the results. This way they could only they could just concentrate on their development. But as organizations have evolved and have done 360s, then a lot of times their manager or boss gets involved in it. And certainly that's important, because if it is for development, the individual can't develop in a vacuum. So somehow the boss needs to be brought in, whether they see a summary of the results or the detailed results, that would be usually up to the recipient or the person who's working with the recipient. Sometimes in some organizations, HR gets involved. With each of those, there's pros and cons. And you can imagine that, again, as we said earlier, we want this to be a developmental experience for a person, not a judgment or an evaluation. But, again, you can't develop in a vacuum. You need the support of other people. Also, it depends on the culture. So besides when Rick talked about the readiness of a 360, you have to look at the organization, and does the culture allow more than just a recipient to see the 360 in a healthy way? I'm trying to advance this, Susan, here.
There you go.
So the next topic has to do with the questionnaire itself. And so certainly the first thing that you want to be thinking about is when we talk about the questionnaire, are the items. Typically, they are consisting of behaviors. That's what we sometimes use interchangeably between items and behaviors, and those are grouped under categories, or we call them competencies. There's different opinions about how long the questionnaire should be. I personally like to have it 30 to 50 items, I've seen some questionnaires up to 100 items. I personally, I think that's very long, but it's really depending on what the organization desires to accomplish. Certainly, we need to be looking at the rating scale. There are different types of rating scales, from frequency to the extent you agree or disagree, or how is this person in relation to average, above average, below average, etc. And there's debate about different types of rating scales as well. The questionnaire typically has open-ended questions. The standard one would be two questions at the end. What are this person's greatest strengths? And what one or two areas that this person were improved in would provide the most value for him or her? Whatever you do, I think it's valuable to pilot test the 360 to make sure the items are understandable, they're interpreted the same by everyone. If it's done online, then I think you want the IT department to be involved to make sure that there's no firewalls or any other IT issues. You want to know how long also it takes to complete. And you need to establish how long you can allow it to be available for people to complete. Then communications is the next thing to be thinking about. You need to explain to the 360 recipients why this is being done. If it's an individual, it may be very easy. Just talk to them personally. But if it's a group of people, you may do it through a letter. But they need to understand that this is being done for a positive reason, not for them to think that they did something wrong. The raters themselves need to be notified. Rather than all of a sudden getting this questionnaire by surprise and say, what is this, they need to understand that their feedback is being valued and being asked for. Again, I'll refer to what Rick had said earlier. Orientating people, both the raters and the recipients, about the 360 project yields a lot of positive benefits. And then the last area I want to cover is thinking and planning through how you're going to deliver results. You could do that in person, over the phone. Obviously, if you could do it in person, that's the best way, but sometimes that's not practical. You got to think through who's going to deliver the feedback. Usually, in terms of how long it takes, I allow 2 hours, but it could vary for different individuals. Part of it may also depend on if you allow them to see their results before you actually deliver the results, and that's also up to the organization and the individual. And you need to be thinking about, when you deliver results, what are the next steps?
Thank you, Mark. I wanted to just do a real quick commercial for you before we continue with the presentation this morning, and to let you know that you will all be invited following this event by the person who invited you here today if you are interested in joining us at a showcase for the 2020 Insight and DISC 363, which are the two 360 degree feedback tools that we have in our 360 degree toolbox. The person that invited you today will be giving you some more details about that, but right now you might want to pencil that into your calendar and hold the date if you have interest in joining us. Okay, the next topic that we're going to explore together today is 360 is not just for problem performers. Rick, would you take this for us?
Sure, thank you. Kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about having your readiness survey and making sure that you're setting this whole thing up in a positive context. We have, and I'm sure others have, looked at 360 feedback as something to use when people are not performing well. We want to gather data. We want to tell them what's wrong. We want to tell them how they can fix the problem. What happens with that is you end up with what we might call this problem children only syndrome. And of course, if you're doing that, you have to ask yourself, do you think others are unaware? Of course, others know that person is probably having problems, and then when they see the 360 come in, that defines your application of 360 feedback. It starts getting people thinking about, well, gosh, what if I'm nominated or asked to do a 360? It removes the possibility of being truly developmental. And as I experienced once, you don't want to walk into a department, or in my case, walking into an organization, and people start feeling a little nervous because here comes that guy that does things that people end up getting fired or whatever. So you want to try and avoid this at all possible. As I said before with the pilot, if you can start out with some of your top executives and make it as positive a process as possible, because everybody needs feedback. Studies have shown over and over again that people actually desire feedback, and they start feeling a little insecure if they're not getting feedback, if people aren't letting them know that they're doing a good job, or maybe if they're not doing everything exactly right, holding it back until it's too late. So people really want to know how they're doing. So make sure that you set it up so it's something that is for everyone, not just your problem children. And there are some other ways to use 360 feedback. For those who are on the call who are in the training and development industry, which I suspect quite a few of you are, you're probably very familiar with Kirkpatrick's four levels of program evaluation. Well, level three in that model is looking at behavior change. Is the program or the intervention or whatever it might be, is it actually resulting in a change of behavior? And so 360 feedback is just a marvelous tool where you can use it for pre- and post-evaluation of behavior as viewed by stakeholders. So, for example, if you're doing a supervisory training program, you can get feedback on the behaviors that you're going to be teaching in that program before people come into the program. So where are they now? What's the baseline? Do your training, do your coaching, whatever, and then 6-9 months later, revisit that evaluation, use 360 again, and you should be able to show that there's been improvement. ASTD has a wonderful info line document on that topic, and I'd encourage you to take a look at it if you're interested in that approach. Another good use of 360 feedback is in succession planning, where you can start to identify emerging leaders. If you're getting feedback on behaviors that you know are going to be important as your organization moves forward into the future, you're starting to identify those folks who are very good at those behaviors. You can start to evaluate organizational roles. What are some of the things that are going to be needed in the organization as you move forward? Another good one that I'd like to recommend is put under the heading of values clarification. Many organizations have a list of what they call their core values or corporate values or organizational values. But how do you know if people are actually walking the talk? Can you take those values and come up with observable behaviors so that anybody could look at somebody's behavior and give them feedback on how well they are using that behavior? So in other words, are they walking the talk of the values of your organization? Another place that we've used this, which is similar, is with teams who come up with ground rules or guidelines or ways that they agree to work with one another, and then every once in a while evaluate each other using 360 feedback to find out how they're being perceived by the other members of the team, and are they behaving the way they all agreed that they would behave. So there's a lot of ways that you can use 360 feedback, staying away from that problem child syndrome.
Thanks, Rick. To norm or not to norm, that is the question, and I will take this topic. The fundamental question that faces the HR professional or the internal OD practitioner is to determine whether the feedback is positive or negative. And we're going to offer five basic ways that you can do this. The first is called absolute value, and this is simply looking at the percentage of people that responded favorably and also looking at the business impact. So for example, if you have a 70% favorable response that the manager provides recognition on a job well done, you may still want to address this as an issue because this particular behavior impacts both morale and retention in your organization, and you have a 40% response that is unfavorable. The second is internal norms, and these are the gaps between the target group in your organization, the people getting the feedback, and some kind of an internal comparison group. Maybe it's the total division to which the target group belongs. So if the target group is significantly higher or lower than the comparison group and there's not a real clear reason as to why this is, then this should be flagged as something that you want to explore. Next, we have relative scores. These examine which items are most positive or most negative. It's just a ranking of some kind. In general, we would focus on those items that are most negative because they're going to yield the largest returns for the organization. Next, we have trend comparisons, and this involves examining which items or categories have improved or deteriorated over time. Now, it's important to note that this really needs to be the exact same survey to use this. This is one of the most valuable comparisons because past employee survey data is going to be the most logical baseline for the target group, comparing them to their own previous results. Also, it's a good measure of how interventions are actually addressing problem areas in the organization. Then finally, of course, we have external norms, and this is the topic at hand. And it really involves simply comparing the target group, the people that are the subjects getting the feedback, to employees that actually work in other organizations. Let's explore this. Maybe. There we go. So I'd like to make, first of all, the case for, whoops, I went too far, the case for external norms. And the first thing I'd like to say about this is that they can help us understand if the data is positive or negative. So for example, if 40% of employees say that they're not satisfied with their pay, you might wonder if this is at a dangerous level. But you might feel differently if you found out that you're really on par with other organizations and that the average out there is about 30%. And the second reason is that norms can help us overcome the problem with ranking. This is kind of related to the first argument, but the normative data can help companies prioritize their actions and resource allocation. Employees typically are going to have less favorable responses in some areas more so than others, for example, pay. So norms will help provide a context for understanding these differences so you don't end up spending time or money on things that really aren't significant or important. And then finally, some companies just feel they need to know how they compare in a highly competitive environment. So this is the case for. Let's take a look at the case against norms. Norms are not really accurate unless the survey items that you're using in the comparison are absolutely identical. Furthermore, they should be from the same industry and approximately the same size, and they should occur during the same time period. And these requirements we find are rarely met. Secondly, the items that you're targeting should really be the areas that are most important to your business strategy and your business objectives. Sometimes we find that organizations are compromising what they really need to know just to get norms. Then we have standards of excellence, and certainly there are companies that don't care whether they're better than worse than other companies. In a survey, it's their standards of excellence that really count. They want to determine if these are, areas that they need to improve on regardless of what other companies are doing. Then there are better ways to really tell that whether the data is positive or negative. We've just shared four of those in the previous slide. They can also give you a window into this need. So we would like to share our position with regards to norms. And our position is that good is the enemy of great, and that norms can create a tendency for us to say, gee, it's okay to be like everybody else. When we look at the comparison data, we're okay. And, we don't want to see organizations that we work with strive to be average. We feel that a developmental process, a 360 process, is developmental, which means that people need to be continually growing and stretching to new levels of achievement. There is also not any research that shows that norms actually motivate people to change. So let's take a look at our next tip today, which is the use of supplemental interviews, and I'd like to turn it back to Mark.
Thank you, Susan. One of the things that we all realize, as soon as I can get this, there we go, for the 360 project that we're doing is that we're trying to get useful and objective information which enables the individual to improve. And by improve, I mean either they are much better in their current job and or it prepares them for the next job. Now, those of us who've been involved in 360s sometimes recognize that the ratings and the comments that we get may not be quite enough. And by that is, you know, typically you get a number from 1 to 5, and get it, when you get an average, it could be like 3.27. And Susan talked about norms, but that might not be as helpful as comments. But comments, you know, people are only willing to provide so much information. They may not want to reveal who their identity or go into too much depth. So there really is a need for three things here, is to get underneath the comments to determine what really is, sift through the feedback, what are the most important areas to focus on, and what I call the business case or the so what question, what would be the impact if this person didn't improve in a particular area? So when conducting supplemental interviews, first off, we know them and it's important that they be confidential. I usually will take a sample of 3 to 4 people or raters, and to further make this confidential, the recipient or the subject of the 360 does not know who is being interviewed in this process, so it's truly anonymous and confidential. Typically, the interview is done over the phone, allows you to take a lot of notes, and it lasts anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes. Sometimes it's even shorter than that. It's the use of probing questions that allow you to get underneath the comments that are being said. And you're not just going to be focusing what just one person said. Since you're interviewing 3 to 4 people, you want to identify themes. And again, with the probing questions, allows you to get at what we would call the so what of the behavior, the necessity to be different or to be better. Now, when you get to the feedback session, this is where the supplemental interview results really come in handy. This allows you to reveal the themes, to supplement what was said in the ratings and the written comments, and certainly you're not going to reveal what any individual person said. You want to link it to the category or the competency, and when you do that, you want to be able to explain why this is so important for this person to pay attention to. Again, the supplemental interviews and what you do at the feedback session allows you to describe in more detail not just what currently is going on, but the desired behavior, and then that allows you to move into identifying practical suggestions on ways this person could improve. And then the supplemental interviews really allow you to add a lot of meaning to the feedback. And certainly, and Susan and Rick talked about this earlier, what I call the fuel for the individual in motivating them to be even better. Susan?
Thanks, Mark. We're going to take a look at our last tip today, which is to build in sustainability for change. And I'd like to turn it over to Rogine.
Thank you, Susan. Well, this is really about how to build that sustainability in for the change that we're trying to help people create. And as we all know, change is difficult, behavioral change is difficult, but we want to really assist people with behavioral change that lasts. So let's look at where to start. Interestingly enough, we don't start thinking about sustainability at the end of the process, we start thinking about sustainability at the beginning of the process. As some of my colleagues have already discussed, we look at and make sure that people understand what is expected of the process. What do we expect of the subjects? What do we expect of the raters? Also of administrators? Also of the managers? But expectations need to be very clearly defined so people can be confident as they move forward. People come with concerns always as this program is beginning to be talked about and beginning to be implemented. Confidentiality is the most important thing. People want to know not only who, and Mark has covered that very well, but they want to know not only who is going to see the information, but how is it going to be used, where is it going to be stored, and then how many reports are going to be printed. if any of them are going to be printed. So it's very important to assure people that they are going to be taken care of and that this information is going to be handled with very great concern as well from everybody. In order to assure objective, observable feedback, when people are being provided the orientation to the 360-degree process, as has been carefully talked about already today, it's really helpful if we ask the raters to practice giving feedback that meets these objective, observable criteria. It's very interesting to me about how difficult it is the first time around. And we usually find that it's really important to help people write it again so that it really does sound very factual versus very personal. So we encourage that a great deal. As we move forward, we look at also telling them how important support is to the whole process. We want to encourage them to understand fully that we are going to support them as they get their reports and as they look at what are they going to do with this data. So the first thing we encourage highly is that each subject creates an individual development plan. There are lots of formats that they can use to do that, and it's important to find one that is going to be something they will do. The follow-up that the individual development plan provides to the 360 process is very, very important and very helpful. A lot of people have a development plan that is more like a journal. They've got their goals at the top, and then they journal how the progress, you know, what's happening, how well am I doing, what did I do today about this. We also want to be sure that people have coaching available to them after they have completed the process. It's so helpful to have someone sitting alongside them as they struggle with what is it they need to do and how are they going to do this in order to really make the improvements that they've already self-determined they want to make. Another nice way to provide support is if they're looking for an expertise or a skill that is much more in depth than what they have done in the past, we can help them locate a mentor, someone who has that expertise, someone who has that skill, who is willing to mentor them and really help them understand how to begin to use that particular technique or skill as they continue to work in their individual development plan. Training is a great way to follow up with the 360 feedback, and a lot of people love the interaction of being in a training session with others who are working on the same thing. So be sure that you make that one available as an option for follow-up as well. As we move forward, and I'm going to fast forward you now from the setting up the process so that we have sustainability, but also how do we prepare them to hear the data that is going to be in their report. The first thing that we do is to ask them, how do you receive positive feedback? When somebody says you do a really great job about XYZ, what's your response? One of the things we tend to hear most often is, oh, of course I do that well. It's my job. And we go, no. That's not good enough. We want you to understand and appreciate those things that are your strengths, those things that you already do really well, and to take another look at those skills and at those strengths to see, are there other ways that you can use them? They're easy for you to do. You've done them for a long time, but how about, is there another way so that you can maximize the impact of your skills and your strengths? The second question on this page is, how do they hear constructive criticism? Do they get defensive right away? Do they get hurt? Do they withdraw? And this question can actually generate a lot of fun as people really begin to look at how difficult it is to hear constructive criticism and that we've asked for input, feedback, that will help us see where we do need to improve. So let's get with the program and be ready to hear those things and then decide, okay, what do I need to do about that? It's actually quite a fun part. Integrating reinforcement. This really goes right along with the follow-up and the support, but how can we really help them make sure that the behavior changes are going to happen and that they can be sustained? We recommend to choose one or two areas for improvement at a time and take their time and do it thoroughly so that it does become a habit. You know, we all know about SMART goals, and we know that it takes up to 21 days of consecutive behavior for something to become a habit. So let's help them, you know, be very committed to making sure that those things happen. We identify resources for them and for the development that may include job aids that they can have right at their desks. It may be books. It may be articles. One of the things I'm finding currently that is most helpful are the blogs, because blogs tend to come across as more personal, and they come across as sharing people's experiences. And so we try to hook people up with a blogs that will help to reinforce the areas and the items that they're working on to improve. And the last one is DVDs, anything you know, that they can watch on their own time and really begin to notice how to implement what it is they need to be doing. It's very important that as consultants, whether you're an internal consultant or an external consultant, that we assure the organizations they are going to get a return on their investment. Not only does the organization need to get a return on their investment, but the subjects do too. They've invested their time. They've invested their thought. In some cases, they may even have invested some risk. So we want to make sure that this is going to be a very positive and helpful process, as well as one that really pays off and will contribute to their career long term. Be an encourager. Be there. Be there to be just checking in informally. How are you doing? How's it going? Any questions you have for me, or is there any way that I can help you as they begin to implement their individual development plan? Sometimes our clients really want a formal evaluation of their progress with the individual plan and will set up periodic formal evaluation processes. I think it's very important to look at what the culture in your organization will benefit from and will support to figure out just how you're going to follow up excuse me, so that this individual plan actually gets implemented. Because there's no perfect plan, it's very important to be aware of the need for flexibility. Maybe halfway through the plan, you notice that, oh my goodness, we need to adjust this a little bit. Something has changed in the environment. Something has changed as you have begun to implement your development plan. But be prepared to help them be flexible, to adjust that plan as needed. And then the last piece, excuse me, is really keeping people accountable. Excuse me just a minute. Sorry about that. When we have set it up the way we started out talking, with the orientation, with the clarifying expectations, with answering their questions about concerns, etc., then one of the things that is also helpful is if we really get a sense of their commitment to the process and ask what would help them to make sure that they get the return on investment that they're counting on. This is their career. This is their development. Let's help them to be accountable as they move forward. We're pretty much at the end of our 360 feedback process. We want to remind you again about the challenge of doing it right, which will be a presentation about two tools that we have used over the years and have found very, very helpful. They're quite different in the way that they're presented and in the way that we work with them, but we'd like to showcase those for you in August, Wednesday, August 24th. The time will be the same. The format will be the same. It will be the four of us presenting different viewpoints and processes so that you can feel confident about the process you use in order to really provide really good career development for your people. We recognize greatly that people in their exit interviews are starting to say, I need to leave because I haven't been able to learn anything more. I've learned everything I can here. So we want to make sure that we're contributing to the continued growth. So back to you, Susan.
Thanks, Rogene. I appreciate that and wanted to open this up for questions. I'm going to take us off of mute for just a moment, and if anyone has a question for anyone today, please feel free to raise it. Okay, you should be off of mute. If anyone has any kind of question related to our topic today, we are here for you to discuss and hear your questions.
Susan?
Yes.
This is Henry.
Hi, Henry.
I want to start by apologizing at the beginning. I was the one playing with the control. I didn't realize I had that.
That's okay. You're forgiven.
I do have a question. If it was stated, I missed it, and I apologize. What's the difference between mentoring and coaching?
Who would like to take that?
I think mentor. I'll take a stab at it. I think mentoring to me is someone with a very specific expertise. So the process is very, very focused on what the learning will be about. And it needs to be set up with someone who's very willing to mentor, to share mm-hmm. that expertise, so that I think it's the focus. Coaching is often, in my opinion, really bringing out what people already know and trying to help them see how to expand their current knowledge about things. That's my take.
Okay, excellent.
Thanks, I think that's
Rogene,
yeah,
would
I think
help
that's
if
a,
you would speak up.
I'm sorry?
It would help if you would speak up.
Okay, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to be
yeah, that,
too quiet. That's usually
that
not
was
what
a, that was a, I think that was a good definition, and I would concur. And any other questions? Okay. Well, we will give you all a gift of time and invite you to go back to all of the things that are sitting on your desk waiting for you today. Once again, we'd like to thank you for joining us and hope to see you on August the 24th.